We're in the 44th and 5th chapter, and I've just read 44 in verse 3 and introduced the prince. Prince, and raised the question, who is the prince? And that's what we're going to try to determine from this, who is this one. And dropping down in chapter 45, now to verse 7. And whatsoever is for the prince shall be on the one side, and on the other side of the holy oblation and of the possession of the city, in front of the holy oblation and in front of the possession of the city on the west side, and so on. All I want to notice is that the prince is introduced here, and here he's on one side, and on the other side here were the people. Now verse 8, in the land it shall be to him for a possession in Israel, and my princes shall no more oppress my people, but they shall give the land to the house of Israel according to their tribe. In verse 9, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, let it suffice you, O princes of Israel, remove violence and spoil, and execute justice and righteousness, take away your exactions from my people, saith the Lord Jehovah. Then he goes on telling them to use a just balance and just measures, and so on. And move on over to chapter 46. Here it says in verse 22, and upon that day shall the prince prepare for himself and for all the people of the land a boat for his sin offering. Come down to chapter 46 there. He mentions again here in verse 2, and the prince shall enter by the way of the porch of the gate without, and shall stand by the post, and so on. Now drop down to verse 4, and the burnt offering that the prince shall offer unto Jehovah shall be on the Sabbath. And verse 8, and when the prince shall enter, he shall go in by way of the porch and go out the same by the south there. Now drop down to verse 10, and the prince, when they go in, shall go in the midst of them, and when they go forth, they shall go forth together. But all right, that down in verse 12 again, and when the prince shall prepare a freewill offering for the people, and so on. And two or three other times, just two more I'll mention. Verse 16, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, if the prince give a gift unto any of his sons, it is his inheritance. It shall belong to his sons, and so on. Well, then you have it again down verse 17 and 18. That's enough. Now, you'll notice how many times, I believe if I counted correctly, the word prince occurs either 15 or 17 times, and princes plural twice in this teaching here. I raise the question, who is the prince? Well, one commentator whom I have a great deal of regard for usually, an old German, Kyle and Daly's set of commentaries, Kyle has the idea and tried to argue that it is the Messiah. Now turn back with me to the 34th chapter of Ezekiel and the 37th, 34 and 37. And here we have Ezekiel, 34 and 37. Now look in chapter 34, verses 23 and 24. If you found your place, Ezekiel 34, 23 and 24. And I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David. He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. And I, Jehovah, will be their God, and my servant David, prince among them. I, Jehovah, have spoken it. All right, now there is a David to come, which is the Christ, the Messiah, the son of David. God said, I'll set him up as prince over my, or among my people there. And David shall be prince among them. All right, now turn to the 37th chapter, and about verse 24, I believe it is, or 23. And I will sanctify my great... No, excuse me. It is in verse 24, and my servant David shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd, and they shall also walk in mine ordinances and observe my statutes to do them, and they shall dwell in the land. And I drop on down in the latter part of verse 25 and 26 there. David my servant shall be their prince forever. Well, I'll make a cover with it. Now here in these two passages, God promises that David will be their prince. Now, Kyle argues that Jesus, that this is the prince over here, but it can't be so. Now, what did you notice among the passages I read? There were three things there that I think make it impossible for Jesus to be the prince of these chapters, the Messiah to have been the prince. Now, look back here at what we had a moment ago in this 45th chapter, first of all. Well, in the 45th chapter here now, verse 8 and 9. In the land it shall be to them for a possession in Israel, and my princes, plural, shall no more oppress my people, but shall give the land unto them. Now here, princes. Now Jesus Christ is the King of kings and Lord of lords. There was not a successor to him, nor was there another with him. So I think that would do it. Now look at verse 9. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, let it suffice you, O princes of Israel, remove violence and spoil and execute justice and so on. So first of all, I would object, I can't accept it as the Messiah, because God speaks of the princes, plural. And Jesus was the king and the only one. Now drop down here in the same chapter to verse 22. And upon that day shall the prince prepare for himself and for all the people who are in a billet for a sin offering. Did Jesus ever need a sin offering? No. The book of Hebrews points out that he didn't offer that for himself, but for the people. So that, I think, would deny it. The prince would not make a sin offering for himself and the people. Now, as I pointed out in preaching on John, and I'll do it again tonight, and one of my points in my lesson tonight, that is that Jesus always identified himself as one of the people, but yet apart from the people. In his relation to Jehovah, it was always, your God, my God. Over and over in John, he speaks of the Father as my Father, my Father, my Father. And you go tell my Father and your Father, my God and your God, he said to that woman, that I'm raised from the dead. All right? So Jesus always separated himself from the people in his relation to God. He was one with them as a man, as a human being. 16 and 17. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, if the prince give a gift unto any of his sons, it is his inheritance, it shall belong to his sons, it is their possession by inheritance. But if he give of his inheritance a gift to one of his servants, it shall be his in the year of liberty, then it shall return to the prince. But as for the inheritance, shall be for his sons. All right? So now, that eliminates Jesus. He had no sons. He had no ancestor nor descendant in his priesthood and kingship, Hebrews the 7th chapter. And he did not offer sacrifice for himself there. We know that. And the other one there that we suggested unto you, the plural number there. So I'll eliminate that. All right? Now that leaves us with two other alternatives, I think, that we might suggest unto you. All right? Now second, if we look at him here, did this have reference to the rulers on the return from the captivity of what they should be? Now that's a possibility. I can accept that. It's possible that he's talking here about the rulers, the prince, those that will rule when they come back. For if you should read these chapters very carefully, you'll see that this prince is as one of the worshipers, separate in a sense that he offers on one side and there another. But at the same time, he is a worshiper, and he's Lord of Lords. Revelation 17:14, also in 1:4-5, he is the ruler of the kings of the earth. Right, so these are subject to it. Now in the 13th chapter, now we have that back in Jeremiah 10, verses 6 and 7. I could read that, I believe we will, since it comes to mind. Look at Jeremiah 10 here, and verses 7 and verse 10. I've heard this many times, you may recall it, may not. But let's turn to it and look at it. Now, here in chapter 10 and verse 7, there is none like unto the old Jehovah. Thou art great, and thy name is great in might. Who should not fear thee, O King of the nations? So he's King of the nations, don't you see? Now drop on down to verse 10. But Jehovah is the true God. He is the living God and everlasting King. At his wrath the earth trembleth, and the nations are not able to abide his indignation. Then over in Psalm 22, that great Psalm of the crucifixion of Jesus. Now notice what it says in verse 28. For the kingdom is Jehovah's, and he is the ruler over the nations. Right? So, and you remember Daniel 4:7. We can read a lot of the passage. Daniel 4:17, where there, Jehovah ruleth in the kingdom of men, setteth up over whomsoever he will, and all of that. Right? So the Old Testament taught over and over that Jehovah is the king of the nations. He rules among the nations. He uses them. Now, back to my passage here in Matthew 13:24. Another parable said he before them, saying, kingdom of heaven is likened to a man that sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares also among the wheat and went his way. Now, the kingdom of heaven there is that which he sows. But you move on down, but when the blade sprang up and went on that, you remember the harvest, let it alone till then. Now turn to verse 36. Then he left the multitude and went into the house, and his disciples came unto him, saying, explain unto us the parable of the tares of the field. And he answered and said, he that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man, and the field is the world. Now notice there, the field is the world, and now then God is in which there is the king, the spiritual kingdom, and Satan's kingdom. All of these are in the world, don't you see? Right? And he answered and said, he that soweth the good seed of the Son of Man, the field of the world, and the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy that sowed them is the devil, and the harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are angels. And therefore the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be in the end of the world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angel, and they shall gather out of his kingdom. So that's the harvest at the end of the world there, and the world there is the realm. Out of his kingdom, all things they call stumbling, them that do iniquity, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He that hath ears, let him hear. Now I think that parable is an exception to most of them. In which here, the kingdom is the whole world, the field, that don't you see? Now here the good seed, that's the seed that Jesus sowed, and the harvest there are the good people in that kingdom. Now then the devil sows the tares, but let them alone. They abide together, but he sends forth his angels and gathers out of his kingdom. For his kingdom included all those that were sold by the devil and those that were sold by Christ. Right? Now gather out these and cast them into the furnace of fire, where the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. So what I'm trying to say now is that Jesus, or rather God, ruled in all the nations, the kingdom of men as well as the spiritual kingdom. These two are side by side. Now, turn with me now to Romans, the 13th chapter. That sounds good, doesn't it? Turn with me to Romans, the 13th chapter. Passage that I preached on not too long ago when I studied Romans, you remember? Now, Romans 13, 1 through 5 or 6. Whatever soul be in subjection to the high powers, for there's no power but of God. That's your civil powers. And the powers that be are ordained of God. Therefore, he that resisteth the power withstandeth the ordinance of God. And they that withstand shall receive for themselves judgment. The rulers are not a terror to the good work, but to the evil. And wouldest thou have no fear of the power, do that which is good, thou shalt have praise from the same. Now notice, for he that is the power, the civil power, he is of God. Now notice, he is a minister of God, a servant of God, to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is a minister of God, second time he says that, and avenger for wrath to him that doeth evil. Wherefore, you must needs be in subjection, not only because of the wrath, but also for conscience sake. For this cause you pay tribute also, for they, that are the rulers, are ministers of God's service, attending continually upon this very thing. Right now, three times Paul makes the statement that the civil rulers are ministers of God. They are, the civil powers are ordained of God. Right? Now, that doesn't mean that God set up a democracy here or some other form yonder, an oligarchy, monarchy, and so on, a dictatorship. No, man chooses the type of government he may have. But God ordains civil government. That's the point there. So the ruler and the prince in the civil government is a minister of God, serving him in this particular matter. And a danger of for wrath on them that are evil. Now look also at 1 Peter, the second chapter. Note what Peter says here, 13. No, 13, second chapter. Be subject to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or under governors sent by him for vengeance on evildoers, and for praise to them that do well. For so is the will of God, that by well-doing you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men as free, and not using your freedom for a cloak of wickedness, but as bond servants of God. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. What? Now these passages teach us that the civil power and the civil ruler is a minister of God. What? So then, this is what I believe that the prince is, who the prince is in these chapters that have been studied. That the prince represents the civil rulers, and God tells them how they're to act. And if they come in, if you read those chapters carefully, when the prince comes in to worship, why, he's just a worshiper, that's all. He is not, he doesn't rule in the religious kingdom. So I think that Ezekiel here, in all of this, is setting forth the principle that under the new, there will be a separation between the civil power and the minister of God. Here's what he's doing. I believe that as you study, if you just read there, some of the passages I didn't deal with much, but I'm trying to find out what was said about the prince in here. Because just take every passage that deals with the prince in these two chapters, I think that you'll come up with that conclusion. At least that's the one I draw. So I offer you three conclusions. Now, I said, well, I don't know who the prince is. I don't know it. But the evidence, to me, the evidence is that he is not the Messiah. I eliminate that at once. And second, that second, he offers sacrifices for himself. That eliminates the Christ. He has sons. That eliminates the Christ. He fools. That eliminates the Christ. So it is not the Christ. Now then, it is the rulers when they return from Babylonian captivity, what they had to do. Now I recognize this, that there's kind of an intermingling and a blending of what God would have of the ideal when they return from captivity, and what the ideal will be when realized in the coming of the Messiah. So there's a possibility that it could refer to these, but when I look at the whole of the nine chapters and see that he's dealing primarily with a spiritual temple and a spiritual kingdom and the spiritual people under the Messiah, under the shepherd and the prince of David back in 34 and 37. When you're dealing with that, now then, he's setting forth the principles of civil government in its relation to the spiritual government. If the prince wants to come into worship, he worships as an ordinary worshiper. As a prince, he's to rule over the people with justice and equity and all of that, because he's answerable to God. Now, does that seem reasonable to you when you look at those passages in the Old Testament concerning God? When you look at the parable of Jesus in the 13th chapter there, when you look at what Paul and Peter said concerning the ruler, what John said when he said he's the ruler of the kings of the earth, God is, Christ is. Christ is King of kings and Lord of lords. He's Lord of lords and King of kings, and he rules with a rod of iron in that kingdom. When I look at that, then Ezekiel is looking to the time of the spiritual kingdom in the world, and here's the prince, and his relation to it is to deal justly with the people, which is answerable to God. I believe that's the lesson that Ezekiel is teaching. That's a great one. But he does it in such a way that a person got to study a whole lot of the passages in relation to it. in order to come up with the idea. Any question over that? I'd like to have any questions or discussion from you if you have anything you want to add to that. Anybody? Yes, ma'am.
Would it be classified that the prince is left?
Ma'am?
The prince is in charge of the rule of law?
Yes, ma'am. That would be the civil rulers. And the unit is singular now as the prince standing for the whole of those rulers, whoever he may be, whether president or governor or what. He is responsible for the enforcement of civil laws, but he is a servant of God, answerable to God, and not a God himself, like some of the rulers think they are. Yeah. All right. Now we'll move on from that, and that pretty well covers that 45th and 6th chapters, all the things in it. Now in the 47th chapter, now he moves on now to a river here, and a beautiful picture, but our problem again is, what is this river deal with? I'll point out what I think it is. And he brought me back, chapter 47, and he brought me back into the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house was toward the east. Well, you remember that the tabernacle faced the east, the temple faced the east, and now then he has this spiritual temple also facing the east here in his picture. And the waters came down from under the right side of the house on the south of the altar. Then he brought me out by the way of the gate northward, and led me round by the way without under the outer gate, by the way of the gate that looketh toward the east, and behold, there ran out waters on the right side. Now, when you in Jerusalem here, here was the here was, I just let this represent the whole thing here. All right. Now, and then of course you have the wall around about it, you know, and a thick wall. Now the waters came out from here, flowed down this way, flowed down toward the Arabah, toward the east. Now here was the Valley of Kidron. Over here was the Mount of Olives. Here was the Mount of Olives over here. Here was the Kidron Valley. So it flowed down around here toward Dead Sea. Now this land from Jerusalem here, when you pass by Mount of Olives, then you're looking down into some of the most desolate waste country, I guess, you'll ever find anywhere. It's made up of canyons, dry, and very little life till you get down to the Dead Sea, and there's no life there at all. I mean, in the Dead Sea, in it. Right, now, this river is flowing eastward into that kind of territory, down through that kind of ground, desolate. Canyons and all of that sort of thing, and just very little vegetation of any kind. Right, now notice further, when the man went forth eastward with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits. That'd be about 1,800 feet, 2,100 feet, something like that. He measured 1,000 cubits, and he caused me to pass through the waters that were to the ankles. Right, now here now, as we're going on down through here, I was coming 1,000 feet out of that. This is my quarter in a measurement. Now here it was ankle deep. All right, so this river here is kind of narrow here. Not very deep, just ankle deep. Well, he comes down another 1,000 here. He measures this. This is getting a little deeper now. All right? Again he measures 1,000, verse 4, and calls me to pass through the waters that were to the knees. All right, now here were the ankles. Now here they're to the knees. All right, and it comes on down another 1,000, measures again. All right, again he measured 1,000 and called me to pass through the water that were to the loins. All right, they were up to here now, up to about here. All right, and it's come here then, now then here they're to the knees, now then there to the loins, ankles and the loins. Now there goes another 1,000, measures it, and it was too deep to cross at all. Right to the knees, and again he came to the loins, after he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not cross, could not pass through, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, a river that could not be passed through. Right, now when you get to here, now that it's too deep here to cross at all, and that keeps on going.
So you see here then that it's getting broader and broader. You come on down and deeper and deeper. Now what does that symbolize? Of course, Ezekiel is great on these symbols, and that has some symbolic meaning. But he moves on here. After he measured it, and I couldn't pass through. And he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen this? Then he brought me and caused me to return to the bank of the river. That's a great river now. When I had returned, behold, upon the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and on the other. Right, now here on the bank, now you come down here to the bank. There are trees on this side and there are trees on this side. Right, so now it's become a great river in this vision. Remember, we're seeing a vision now. With trees on both sides. Now it flows on down toward the Arabah, toward the Dead Sea, in which nothing could live. Now when I had then said he unto me, these waters issue forth toward the eastern region and shall go down into the Arabah, and they shall go toward the sea. That's the Dead Sea, now the Salt Sea called in the Bible. Into the sea shall the waters go which were made to issue forth, and the waters shall be healed. Now the waters there in the Dead Sea are very brackish, very salt.